Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Rick Moore. Guest today is Sarah Bryan. You'll find Sarah over in the UVA Department of Drama, where she is the costume shop manager. Although you may not find her, because that's usually in the backstage.
I'm in the basement.
In the basement, yeah. Even.
So it's a hard place to find if you don't know where you're looking.
Well, thank you for coming out.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you being here today. We're going to talk about clothing, the history and the stories behind a lot of clothes that people just see and don't often think about.
Yeah, the evolution of how things have gotten to where they are now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're going to start with one that I don't think people think about. Certainly, I don't and didn't. And just to give a sort of an idea as to what the hour will be about today, I'm pumping fuel one day, and the gentleman next to me is pumping fuel, and he's got his tie on, his going to work business suit tie, and it's obviously in the way. It's hanging down the front, and he's tossed it over his shoulder, and it's repeatedly falling and getting in the way, and he's repeatedly tossing it over his shoulder. And my question to myself is, why is he wearing that? Where does the tie come from? Why do men wear ties? And so I'm thinking, what a great show. What a great show. What's the history of the tie? And then that carries forth into finding someone who can tell me this. And how about so many more pieces of clothing? And that takes me to Sarah Bryan, the costume shop manager at UVA's Department of Drama and the Heritage Theater Festival. Mm-hmm. So let's start there. Why do men wear ties?
Well, you know, when I first got that question from you, in my head, I knew it was an evolution of hundreds of years creating that look, but I didn't know the exact story. So I did a little deep dive myself, and it's believed that the idea of something worn around the neck for men started in 1660 after a war. King Louis XIV, who was a bit of a clothes horse, he was the king in France, started lots of fashion trends, actually, but this was one of them. He met some soldiers from a Croatian regiment who happened to be wearing these silk handkerchiefs around their neck, and he really liked it, and so created his own royal regiment that required the men to wear silk handkerchiefs around their neck, and he called them cravats, which is derived from the word croat, Croatian. So that's where it started, sort of in mass fashion. And it is just a piece of cloth tied around the neck. And then over hundreds of years, it evolves into different things, but it's always a piece of cloth tied around a gentleman's neck. And as we move through more sort of form-fitting clothing and more gentlemen's attire, they feel underdressed if they don't have a tie or a piece of clothing around cloth around their neck. They feel undressed. And when we move into the 20th century, it becomes a part of a business suit. And if you're not well-dressed, you would not have a tie completing your business suit, and you wouldn't be, you know, a businessman without your suit. And it just sort of continued. And this book I was reading said that, you know, men starting out in the business world would see the boss in the boardroom, and he's wearing a tie with his suit and wants to emulate his boss in order to get ahead in his field, and so wears a tie. And it's just continued in the last, you know, 100 and whatever years as a tie, the shape we know as a tie. And the widths have evolved with fashion of the decades. I think back in the 60s or 70s, they were extremely wide, and they're not so wide anymore. Really, a narrower tie is more fashionable now. So,
where does the bow tie come from in all this?
It's another evolution of a thing around your neck, a piece of fabric around your neck. It evolved from something called a stock, which was a piece of narrow cloth, so it wouldn't sort of dangle like a handkerchief would dangle like a tie in your chest. It's more fitted at the neck, and the fabric wraps back around to the front of the neck, and men would tie a bow. And so, again, with evolution of fashion, it's created to be tied at the front and in a bow. And that now is really just personal preference. I don't know that the bow tie in business sense ever, if you would do a tie or a bow tie, meaning one thing or another, other than formal wear, like white tie and black tie generally is a bow tie.
Again, our guest today is Sarah Bryan. She is the costume shop manager at the UVA Department of Drama. The show today comes about from my seeing a gentleman having trouble wearing his tie, mm-hmm. and it actually being functional for him in pumping fuel because it was in the way. It is the tie you... Sarah, you're telling me that it comes about from 150 plus years ago. Is there anything happening in the world today in terms of it being, are there more men wearing it, fewer men wearing it? Do you know that?
Well, I guess just from my observations, and even my own father, who's a banker, he doesn't wear a tie to work anymore, but that's because he doesn't intersect with the public. So if he was meeting the public and having a more public image as a business person, he might feel the need to wear a tie. But I think the world is moving more casual. Ties have been taken over also as fashion. I mean, young guys wear ties just as fashion, not as going to work every day. The sort of quote-unquote hipster might wear a skinny tie without a jacket on, just with a shirt, a button-up shirt. So I think we have both realms. But I do think in business, in the general sense of a business person, a man would still wear a tie with his suit. But maybe he might have wanted to take his tie off while pumping gas. That one's a little... he probably could have easily taken it off.
Or there are also tie clips.
There are tie clips. Although I don't know if they're as fashionable as they once were. But that certainly would have helped his problem.
Right. Again, Sarah Bryan here. Today's show, the history and the stories of clothing. And we have a long list of things here. And Sarah, you taught a class on this. Tell us a bit about your class.
Sure. So I taught costume history at Cal Poly, California State Polytechnic University in San Luis Obispo, California. I used to be the shop manager there for their theater department, and I was a lecturer for the costume history class. And so Cal Poly is a quarter system school, so I had 9 weeks to teach what is traditionally a 16-week course on essentially the history of the world, because fashion is all tied up in politics and economics and social sciences. So I teach that class trying to connect the dots for people. Students generally pick up on things the closer they get to perhaps pictures they have of their grandparents or their great-grandparents. They start to connect things a little more with the silhouettes of what they're wearing.
Now we're going to do it in an hour.
Yeah. We're going to do some tidbits.
So you've gone from, 16 weeks, 12 weeks to 9 weeks to an hour. Good practice for being on Sunday morning wake-up call. So I'm just going to go down my list, and we're just going to pick a few things out.
Sure.
I sent you an idea of things. So let's just pick a few things here as we go through our hour today. Let's talk about maternity wear.
Okay.
Maternity wear. Is this for the mother to be more comfortable, or is this because this happens, is this to hide the pregnancy? Because many people thought that this was, and I'm going to use this word, is this shameful because she had sex?
Right. Well, really for most of history of women having children, they were locked away. They were kept behind closed doors. You wouldn't see them for the 9 months. So there wasn't, we really don't have a lot of information about maternity clothing for hundreds of years of women having children because they would really wouldn't be seen. So there wouldn't be any depictions in art, and clothing wouldn't have lasted that long. It's more than likely they were in bed most of the time. So then we move into sort of the 1800s and the 1900s, and women do start to wear clothing that is not form-fitting, is still trying to hide the fact that they are pregnant. When we were in the corseting period, women still wore corsets when they were pregnant, and that essentially is pushing the baby down, pushing the bump down. So it is very sort of hidden away, shameful. And one of the first things that turned that was Lucille Ball being pregnant on the I Love Lucy show in the 50s. That was a huge turning point where women finally were like, okay, she's pregnant and it's okay. And it can be celebrated. So maternity clothing actually started being created and advertised and sold more so than it ever was before. Now, today, I think things have certainly shifted to both comfort and form-fitting to show off the pregnancy and to be proud of the pregnancy. I think that's certainly shifted in the last 10 years of the extremely form-fitting clothing.
I Love Lucy.
I'm
sure many women are saying that now when they're pregnant.
They probably remember that. Well, they might remember that episode. Some women of a certain age would remember that episode. But yeah, it was still not form-fitting, but you knew she was pregnant.
All right. Maternity wear. Awesome. So let's pick another one here on my list. Oh, I'm going to go to denim jeans.
Ah.
Because denim jeans have really changed. I mean, you go back and denim jeans, and I don't want to take away what you're going to tell us all, but, people think of denim jeans from the working man to the expensive thing, and now you see them, and obviously they even have their, you can buy them, and they've already been cut up. So talk about denim jeans.
So denim really was invented, I believe, Levi Strauss, and I think it was 1847 or 1848. They were invented for gold miners. To pan for gold and to survive in, those conditions of being in the water and being around rocks and needing their pants to last a long time. So, like you said, they really are in its origins for working class. Probably, in my mind, up until the 1940s, perhaps, I think women slowly started to wear denim. But again, for working in factories, so it was still a labor clothing, probably until the 60s, it finally became fashionable. And then, of course, with hippies culture taking over as the denim of their own, it turned into something different than working class. And now, like you say, you can buy them with slashes, which I think is crazy because you can slash your own jeans at home. It has become a totally different part of fashion and fast fashion. Denim has definitely gone into that category than high-end fashion of perhaps the 80s and 90s when you could pay a fortune for a pair of jeans.
Talk about that for a minute. Wasn't it, was it like the, what were some of the brands? Jordache.
Mm-hmm.
When, I mean, a pair of, well, and I don't know the prices to compare, but a pair of Levi's, but I'll say, what does a pair of Levi's cost now?
$40?
$40, and
yeah.
A pair of Jordache at the time could be $200?
Yeah, very expensive.
So is that all name brand, or is that all a quality of denim?
You know, it could have been both. I think definitely in the 80s, where excess was the fashion, I'm sure there was part of it was hiking up prices so that the name brand was really what you were buying, having the Jordache name across your butt was an important status symbol, if you will. And I'm not sure about the quality. You know, jeans used to be made in America. I'm not sure when that went out and went overseas, but I do know that the quality has certainly gone down because people want to pay like $30 for a pair of jeans, and so corners have to be cut. But I don't know that jeans now, in terms of designer labels, are as big a thing as back in the 80s.
You mentioned that the original use for denim was for miners, and then women started wearing them. Did you say the 40s?
I think in the 40s.
Was that for a particular reason?
Well, I think when they started working in factories and taking on the men's jobs and needing clothing that would withstand working in factories. You know, denim is a sturdy fiber. so they wear really well. So I think that's probably when it started. Now, I'm sure there are cases where it was worn outside of working clothing, but off the top of my head, that's what I'm thinking.
Why did the hippie women start wearing them?
I don't know. You know, I think rebellion against what fashion at the time was, which there was a lot of double knit polyester, and moving to, you know, Mother Nature and the earth, and denim is a cotton, and wearing more breathable fabrics. I mean, my God, I cannot imagine wearing double knit polyester now, but it was the height of fashion back then. And hippies were rebelling against what was mass popular culture.
Again, our guest today is Sarah Bryan. She's the costume shop manager at UVA Department of Drama and the Heritage Theater Festival. It's 19 minutes after the hour. We're going to take our first break so we can come back and not cut off the middle of our next question or the middle of our next topic. No, we're going to come back and we'll talk about swimwear for male and females. Hang tight. And we are back on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm Rick Moore. Our guest today, Sarah Bryan, as we talk about the history and the stories of clothing. Sarah is the costume shop manager down in the basement.
Yeah, I know.
At the UVA's Department of Drama. Freed for the hour. Come talk with us and give us some history and tidbits, answer some questions.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I had on the list was swimwear. You know, it's funny, you see some old black and white pictures, and you always see men wearing things almost full-bodied.
Yeah.
from maybe not from ankles to wrists, but certainly from calves to forearms, and women wearing
really fully clothed,
almost with ruffles on them usually.
Right.
And now
it's
a lot of skin, shown. So talk about the difference of swimwear through the from 1800s to the 21st century.
Well, back in the 1800s, again, it was about modesty. I mean, women were fully clothed from high neck to the floor. And so even though the fashion of those swim garments look awful, they did have some exposed skin, which was freeing for them. Now, they were made out of like heavy wool. So once you got into the water, it would have been miserable because you would just be laden down with fully wet wool clothing, both for the men and women. So neither of them are getting out of there very comfy. But again, with the menswear, I mean, they're pretty covered up for today's standards. So again, it's modesty of the era. And it just evolves through the decades and the fashion of the decades. When we get into like the 50s and 60s, the men's swimsuits are a lot shorter. And that was just the fashion of the time. I think a lot of men's fashion in swimwear, I know you mentioned to me a Speedo came from Europe. I think Speedos were invented in Italy for men's swimwear. And so it just traverses over to American fashion, either through media or people traveling. Just the fashions intermingle to today, where I think everything's happening in swimwear now. I mean, more clothed swimwear or more exposed swimwear. I think women especially are moving towards wearing things that they feel are more flattering on themselves instead of trying to fit into a certain style that might have been more prevalent in the 80s with a really high cut bikini that's barely covering anything, to just having more comfort and being comfortable in their own skin and what they like to wear.
Did the war, World War II seems to have played a larger role in a lot of things. Did World War II play a role in taking away a lot of the material by saying, we don't have as much material to give you, so now it's free for you to men to take away a top. You can go top free because we don't have as much cotton to give you. Ladies, if you want to go, if you want to show your bellies, go ahead, because now you can have a two-piece, because we don't have as much material to give you. Did anything happen in those eras?
I'm sure that rationing played a big role. I mean, rationing played a role in all of fashion at the time. But I also think that some of, at least with women's bikinis, I think the idea of the pinup girl for soldiers that was created, that played into women's fashion as well. That they were trying to emulate this pinup girl idea, which included, I think, Betty Grable in a two-piece swimsuit.
Right, and Rita Hayworth.
And Rita Hayworth.
The time, right?
Yeah. So a lot of film stars were dictating things, but that might have also come from perhaps the government who was trying to keep morale for the soldiers overseas. You know, it's all interconnected.
Huh.
Yeah. But rationing, I'm sure, played a part.
Again, Sarah Bryan here, she's the costume shop manager, allowed free from the basement at UVA, come to talk about the history and the stories of clothing. So do you know when the bikini came about, or can you talk about that as we talk about swimwear?
Yeah, I think the like the string bikini, if you will, I think it came in the 60s. And again, I think it was coming from Europe, and women were emulating things from overseas. You know, families were having more exposed income that they could use and were taking trips abroad and seeing other fashions and how other people lived, and that was coming back across, and magazines were showing things overseas, you know, travel advertisements to get people to go overseas, and it all just creates ideas of what we should have in America.
Fascinating. I'm so caught up in learning about this from you as our guest today. 27 minutes after the hour. One of the things I'm always interested in learning about, whether it's with my wife, my mother, any female that I've been around in my wife in my life, accessories. It's like, what earrings should I wear tonight? What necklace is appropriate, or bracelet, et cetera. One of the businesses that I work for, it's always, you know, we need to find the right jewelry. And those things are key. You know, so I'm curious as to how earrings and necklaces for women, and certainly men have their own accessories, suspenders and cufflinks. So let's talk about those for a bit. Let's start with accessories for women.
Sure. So jewelry and adornment has always been a part of dress for women and men in you know, the 1600s and before. Men wore a lot of adornment. But as we move into the sort of more modern times, the turn of the century, and different decades after that, the styles of the decade that are referenced in architecture and art start to show up in jewelry. Like Egyptian was an extremely popular motif in the 1920s because of the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb. So people of high fashion would have Egyptian motifs in their architecture, in their necklaces, also in their details in their garments. What's another decade that has, well, in the 60s, Art Deco, yeah, everything is sort of playing in terms of what's around them. The architecture, the furnishings in a house in the 1960s, the space age was all the rage. So you see that in furnishings and in jewelry. Plastic became very popular in women's jewelry because that was part of the space age. Plastic came out of all of that. So for women's accessories, it kind of comes with the popularity of the time.
But what gets women wearing a necklace in the beginning?
Well, in the really early days, it was a show of wealth. I mean, your money could be tied up in land and in property, but also in jewels. And if you're having expensive jewels, that means you have the money to go get them from wherever they came from in another country, and to have them cut down. So for a man to have his wife with very expensive glimmering jewels on her chest shows that he is very wealthy and high standing in society. And it's another way to put your money somewhere where it might be safer.
To be wearing it rather than putting it in a box.
Right.
somewhere in your closet.
Mm-hmm.
That...
Yeah.
And so I'll assume that the necklace and the earrings fall together in that class of wearing it close to you.
They do.
And show your jewels.
And with earrings, a lot of times that goes along with hairstyles. So different types of earrings, like if your hair is worn up more, a dangly earring is going to be shown off more. So evening wear versus day wear would be different in terms of jewelry. And then also necklines. So the bigger the necklace, as a woman's neckline changes, especially for evening wear. I mean, if we're talking expensive jewels, it's generally worn in the evening, but a neckline of a bodice going up and down also would dictate the type of necklace you would have.
All right, so now you're jumping around all over my list, but so stick with accessories for a minute and jump to men. So I can think that jewels also be part of the cufflink?
Absolutely. You could put jewels in the cufflink, and a lot of upper-class men, like in the 1800s, would have signet rings that would have jewels in them. You could have expensive jewels in men's.
But what would why wear a suspender rather than a belt?
Well, suspenders were very popular at the time of probably turn of the century, because it held the shape of the trouser better, especially if a trouser had pleats. It would hang better on a gentleman when suspended from a pair of suspenders than tucked in with a belt that would create extra wrinkles and disrupt the silhouette of the gentleman. Really, the belt became popular once America started getting into wars, World War One and World War Two. Belts became part of military uniforms, and then the military fashion became fashionable post-war for everyday use.
Interesting. Again, our guest today is Sarah Bryan. She's at UVA's Department of Drama, where she's the costume shop manager. She's also with the Heritage Theater Festival. You mentioned hairdos with... Mm. Showing off earrings. Do you know anything about why the what's the beehive? Do you know where that's?
Oh, yeah, in the 60s.
Yeah. That one's always fascinated me, from the woman with the B-52s.
Yeah.
Music group.
I think it was just a fad of the 60s. I think the extreme beehive, I think, came out of Baltimore. And I don't know why. Hairstyles have just kind of gone up and down. And again, things come from abroad. A lot in the early days, like Marie Antoinette was a big hairstyle icon, and women would see sort of fashion plates, which were drawings that would eventually make their way over to England, and women would try to get their hair that high with rats, which are basically mats of your own hair that you stick in to get your hair to get that high with a bunch of pins. And it's kind of farcical when you look at them now, and how could they get through doorways and all of those sorts of things. But a lot of hairstyles like those were short-lived and not worn for everyday women. Generally for upper class women to show off.
People who had to actually do things.
Right. Couldn't really have hair like that if you have to go and plow the fields.
Right. So let's talk for a minute about your job.
Okay.
and how you have to do things. So when a play comes along, and you're trying to, because you're not just putting together Marie Antoinette's costume,
mm-hmm.
you're having to put together costumes throughout the entire play, correct?
Right, the whole world.
So are you researching it? I mean, tell me how you make the costumes come together.
Absolutely. Well, I think the basis of costume design is the script. That's what an entire design team is working from. And from that, generally, there's a director's world that they're trying to create for the audience, or a theme or a story they want to tell with that particular script. And then once you have those sort of parameters, then I think the foundations of the design are research. At least that's how I do it. I get lost in the research because things could go in all sorts of directions. So I would do different boards for different characters and have tons of images to draw upon. And then if you have the budget to build, you would go from there, or more than likely we're pulling from our own stock. And so you're finding things that resemble what you would like them to look like. And then you work with the actors to see if it fits with what their character is, because the actors are living in the body of that character. So they know a lot that you don't know yet. So I like to have conversations with my actors about if this garment works for them as the character, or were they thinking maybe a different accessory would help them really embody their character.
And you're the costume shop manager.
Right.
So you are creating these.
Well, I don't really design in the academic world in this particular job. So I'm more of a support mechanism, if you will. We have graduate students that do the designing and do all of those steps that I just talked about, because they're learning how to do the design process. But I am there to purchase things. I'm the one with the purchasing card.
You have the credit card.
I've got the money. And then I'm there to help facilitate the builds and the alterations of what we have in stock through our undergraduate lab students that take the sewing class. So then they are the ones executing things that come out of fittings, where we need to take in the center back of a pair of pants or let out something like a hem or a garment that is too small. Sometimes we have to make it too big. And so the lab students are the ones that I'm more involved with.
You talked about purchasing. When you purchase, are you just purchasing a different color cloth? Are you just purchasing, I mean, you're not purchasing a ready-made or a somewhat finished costume.
Right. Yeah. And generally we would never do that, because most of those things are not up to our quality that we want to put on stage. But we're purchasing fabrics. We might be renting costumes from other companies across the country. And we're purchasing shoes, purchasing laundry detergent, because we have to wash things during the run of the shows. And if we have special things we need to wash, like this summer I had to buy some industrial strength dry cleaning stain remover for Pride and Prejudice, because there was a massive stain in the show. And it had to get removed every night so that the next audience wouldn't know that there was a huge ink stain on Lizzie Bennet. And so I have to research those sorts of things as well. So a lot of different elements. I also deal with donations, which a lot of our costumes started as a donation from the public. And that's where we get a lot of our gems, a lot of our vintage, authentic clothes come from donations, and we get to work with the real deal.
That's fascinating. History and Stories of Clothing with Sarah Bryan. She's the costume shop manager at UVA's Department of Drama. We'll be back in just a moment. And back in action here, Sunday morning wake-up call, talking about clothing. All kinds of tidbits I certainly didn't know. I'm fascinated for the hour. Sarah Bryan giving me a personal class. Hopefully you're feeling like you're getting your personal class as well.
Sarah is the costume shop manager at the Heritage Theater Festival, as well as UVA's Department of Drama, freed from the basement for the hour. Sarah, tell me about, you know, I've always wondered about the woman's skirt and how it's gone from very low to somewhat short and seems to be going down a bit again. I've noticed I have a niece who, you know, released her prom dresses or prom pictures and noticed that the photos showed, and she and all her friends had very long hems to them this
That's
year.
That's interesting.
And, as opposed to when my wife was an assistant principal and they had some problems, she was telling
really
me, with
short.
Very short prom dresses. So talk about the woman's hemline,
okay,
if you would.
Well, again, most of fashion history until really the turn of the century was generally long to the floor. There was occasionally like a peak of an ankle, which was scandalous and usually didn't last very long. But generally they were long skirts. It really changes with the Industrial Revolution because women start going and working in factories. And before, most women, except perhaps peasant laborers, were not working and didn't have to do much. And so long skirts were not hindering their ability to work. But when women start going to factories, the hems have to shorten just so that they don't get caught on machinery. So they come to maybe above the ankle a little bit. And then really the big change in hems is the 1920s with the flapper, where women were really rebelling against the conformity of women's fashion. They stopped wearing really constricting corsets and raised their hemlines extremely. But it didn't last forever. They started to lower back down. And it's just sort of changing ideas of modesty over the decades. The hemlines came back up in the 40s, mostly because of rationing. They were trying to save on fabric. It was still modest below the knee, but it was a shorter skirt than the previous decade of the 30s. And then you get into the 50s, where the skirt comes to the knees, and then into the 60s of mod skirts, where they're mini skirts, you know, at your thigh. But moving back into the 70s, the hem goes back down. So it really just changes with women's attitudes, I think, and the thoughts of mass culture. And
it needs to be the alternative of what it was before.
Previously, right. Yeah, you don't want to wear your mother's clothing is a lot of
is
how
your mother
fashion
listening?
Changes. I believe she is, although I do like wearing a lot of what she would have worn back in the 70s.
Where does the, I think it's called the little black dress.
Oh, the little black dress. Yeah, I don't, you know, I think that started maybe in the 80s and 90s. And it really is a construct of a fashion advertising, I think. Although it is genius, because to have a well-fitting, flattering little black dress in your wardrobe, you can wear it to anything in informal life. But yeah, I don't know too much about that one, of when it exactly started.
And I don't think this applies to just men, although obviously being of that gender, but there's the dress for success phrase. Do you know, can you talk about that?
I don't know when it started, but you're right. I mean, it does sort of fall in line with...
It goes back to me, it goes back to where we started the show with the tie.
With the tie. Mm-hmm.
And so that's where... That's what's popping into my head, is you need to be the banker and dress for success,
right,
and wear your suit and tie.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, probably started in the late 70s into the 80s, because really the 80s, I think, played a big role in suits and business people, because women also in the 80s started going into high market jobs and banking and Wall Street, and they would wear their own version of a business suit and still dressing for success and having tailored suits and heels and their own version of a tie. In the 80s, a lot of blouses had this sort of extra fabric that you could tie at the front of your neck that had that look of a men's tie, but in a quote-unquote more feminine fashion. So I think the dress for success really did come about in the late 70s, 80s, moving into that world of excess and making more money, and greed is good.
I'm thinking of Michael Douglas for some reason.
That's where that quote comes from.
Is it?
Wolf of Wall Street.
Let's talk about morning wear.
Okay.
Tell me about that. What can you give me as a history and some stories on morning wear?
Sure. So traditionally, I was looking this up because a lot of people think, when they think of wearing black to a funeral, if you have a concept, a lot of people go back to Queen Victoria, who wore black for 40 years after her husband, Prince Albert, passed away. And that actually created a trend of wearing black just in fashion, not necessarily in mourning. But when I was looking into it, traditionally, the idea of wearing something particularly for mourning started at the end of the 15th century. But the idea of wearing black clothing as a sign of grief started in Northern Europe in the mid-1300s. So it's not a new concept. It's just evolved over time. There were times in like the 17 and 1800s where if you went into mourning, particularly women, they would just put all of their clothes in a vat of black dye and dye everything they owned, because there were different time frames that particularly a widow would have to remain in mourning and could not wear colorful clothing. And if fashions changed by the time you could wear colorful clothing, it wouldn't matter if you dyed all your clothes black of a previous fashion. So that is how it's kind of evolved into wearing black at a funeral. But the ideas of having periods of mourning have shifted, at least in America, where someone is not restricted from wearing color for a certain period of time. But back in the day, it could be months, it could be years with Queen Victoria. So, yeah.
How about the opposite, and white at weddings?
Again, Queen Victoria pops up. She was a bit of a clothes horse herself, and it's strongly believed that her wedding in, I think, 1839 or 1840 to Prince Albert is what started the trend of wearing white. Generally, you would wear your best clothing on your wedding, but she chose to wear like an ivory colored dress, and it was highly advertised at the time in sketches with descriptions in the papers. And so it sort of mass released information in the media, and it became popular and still is today.
52 minutes after the hour with our guest Sarah Bryan from UVA's Department of Drama, as we do some history and stories of clothing here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Here's a topic about underwear.
Mm.
We've got bras for women.
Yep.
That couldn't possibly have always been something that women wore. And boxers for men.
Well, the bra was, again, an evolution from corsets, which were much less comfortable than a bra. It's all about constriction. These foundation garments were about constriction and to fulfill the silhouette of the fashion of the time. So it wasn't in any way meant to support in the early days. It was meant to fashion your own body into the silhouette the garment wanted to be. Until the bra came about as an evolution from the 1920s, really, when women stopped wearing corsets and had these sort of just slip things that they would wear. And then it evolved into having wires and pushing your breasts up. And again, though, fulfilling silhouettes of the high fashion at the time, that situation has evolved as silhouettes have evolved in the past few decades.
Not to ask you to be a psychic, but is the expectation for clothing history that it will change because the silhouette desire will change?
Well, you know, I think at least from what I'm hearing from my students, people are wearing whatever they want to wear now. And I know I have a lot of students that thrift, and so they're getting things that are from previous decades, and perhaps they're not wearing the foundation garments that decade dictated. They're more wanting to wear something comfortable but still have the garment from that decade, but the silhouette is not going to necessarily look the same as was dictated back in the day. I don't know if fashion is being dictated as much by advertisers and the big names that are creating fashion more so than it is the consumer pushing back and wanting things to be a certain way and making their own clothes or choosing not to wear bras and not caring if the silhouette doesn't look right. And I don't know if we'll get back into a time where a silhouette is dictating foundation garments.
How about for men and their undergarments? Where did the, I'm just not sure, because the boxer doesn't really support anything.
No. And I think, you know, I think the popularity of that probably came about in the 80s, maybe. I don't know about in the 70s. But again, it wasn't really for men about fulfilling a silhouette, because trousers, really, they would go between being more narrow or wider, but they're generally always hanging off your waist. And so your undergarment isn't going to necessarily change the silhouette of a pair of pants. So I think that might have just been evolution of men wanting to be more comfortable. And because they're men, they can make those changes.
Because you're in charge. You made all of the choices for most of the centuries.
Exactly.
Just a few minutes left, and probably not enough. I still have a handful of things on here. Major inventions and steps of clothing design. And I found two things, and I want you to tell me. I selected the sewing machine and the zipper.
Mm-hmm.
What did I leave out?
Oh, well, gosh. Obviously, the sewing machine is the big game changer, because that made ready-to-wear a possibility. Beforehand, you were either making your own clothes by yourself, or you were paying a fortune for someone else to make your clothes by hand. So that made it possible for fashions really to change quickly over time, to have ready to wear. I think before the zipper, it was the idea of tailoring. So prehistoric times of wearing togas and just draping fabric versus it having things sewn together and being able to create shapes that fitted the body was a big game changer. And that evolved into being able to have a zipper. I mean, before zippers, you had button flies on trousers. So what else was a big game changer in fashion? I mean, in 1947, Dior's new look really catapulted women's fashion out of rationing in the 40s to extreme high fashion and excess yardage of fabric for skirts and moving into really what we think of as fashion design now, and having a house of one person who's dictating the fashions. That's really the new look by Dior catapulted that.
All right, just 1 minute left in the show. Could you tell me quickly, what's one of your favorite plays that you've done in putting things together fashion-wise?
Oh, my gosh. Well,
it doesn't have to be your number one, because I don't want to make you do that, but just one of your favorites with the fashion.
I really loved a show I did in grad school called Crazy for You, because it's in the 30s. I love the 30s, and it was a conglomeration of multiple rentals and building things from scratch and using things in our own stock and creating an overall world that I hope looked like it was all cohesive. All right. And it's a fun musical anyway.
It's a fun musical. All right. Again, Sarah Bryan, costume shop manager from the UVA Department of Drama. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
I had a fascinating hour. All right, everybody. And we'll be back next week. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.